This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, July 1st, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The 63rd Annual Opera in the Ozarks runs through July 19th at Inspiration Point near Eureka Springs. This festival of fully produced operas is an educational program for singers pursuing a career in the world of opera. The 2013 productions include Elixir of Love, Madame of Butterfly, and Pirates of Penzance. Tickets and more information available at opera.org. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, the ill-fated effort to have the White River watershed designated as a national blueway. It would have been just the second river to have that designation. Plus, Stuart Towns talks to Christina Thomas about his book, Enduring Legacy, Rhetoric and Ritual of the Lost Cause. He says the oratory of Confederate veterans in the years after the Civil War ended has influenced much of the South's perspective since. But first, State Treasurer Charles Robinson is working to reshape his office's policies after former Treasurer Martha Schaffner resigned, facing charges of extortion. Robinson, a former legislative auditor, says he has many changes on his agenda, including employee cross-training, internal control, and separation of duties. In an interview with Talk Business Arkansas, Robinson said that his month in office has been beneficial thanks to feedback he's received from office employees.
And it took about 2 weeks to make the rounds and spend plenty of time. And I'd like to point out, there were some individuals in the Treasury's office made some very informative comments that I think is things that we need to work on. And that, I think we've already got that kind of relationship going, and it was really a good thing to sit down and talk.
Robinson also plans to bring in an outside consulting group next month to help things move forward. Fiscal year 2014 begins today with a new Arkansas budget going into effect. In his weekly radio address, Governor Mike Beebe said the budget includes several changes.
This year, we'll see added funding for key state services, some targeted tax relief, and thanks to voters, a new revenue stream for our highways. What has not changed is keeping education our top priority. We've again allocated more money toward educational adequacy to continue furthering improvements in our K-12 schools.
Governor Beebe says there is also increased funding for Medicaid and higher education. In this new fiscal year, economist John Shelnut with the Department of Finance and Administration says gross general revenue is not expected to grow as much as it did in the previous year.
Part of that is the expectation that individual income tax is going to slow down compared to the just completed year. And that's recognizing that in 2013, taxpayers were anticipating income tax rates going higher at the federal level and shifting income as best they could into tax year 2012.
Tomorrow, Shelnut says the state will release its overall report for fiscal year 2013, which will show how much additional surplus money will be added to Arkansas's General Improvement Fund. Today is the deadline for Arkansans to comment on the recent voter ID law through the Secretary of State's office. The legislation was put into effect earlier this year and requires Arkansas voters to present a photo identification at the time of voting. Secretary of State spokesman Alex Reed says last week's Supreme Court decision regarding the Voting Rights Act does not affect the existence or rules of the ID law.
There were about 9 states that were known as quote-unquote preclearance states, where any time that they wanted to change something in voting procedure, they had to get it cleared through the Department of Justice. And we were not one of those states, so we're not affected by that.
Voter ID rules and public comment information can be found at sos.arkansas.gov. Though he has not announced his bid to run for the U.S. Senate, some in the political realm seem to think that Arkansas's 4th District Congressman Tom Cotton is angling toward challenging Mark Pryor for his reelection to the Senate. Speaking in a political roundtable yesterday with Roby Brock of Talk Business Arkansas, State Senator Jason Rapert, a Republican from Conway, says he thinks Cotton is heading toward a Senate race.
The fact of the matter is the winds are against Mark Pryor in this race. He's been on the wrong side of the issues as it relates to the opinions of the Arkansas people. Now, I respect him and the legacy of his family and actually know Mark, and I believe he's a nice person. I believe if he could, he'd switch parties, but he's in a situation he can't.
While Republicans may see Cotton as a true challenger to the incumbent Senator Pryor, some Democrats seem to think differently. Max Brantley, editor of the Arkansas Times, was also part of the roundtable discussion. He says he thinks that Congressman Cotton's extreme views make him an ideal candidate to oppose Pryor.
Here's a guy who's voted against disaster aid. He's voted against the farm bill. He's voted against food stamps. He wants to go to war against anybody that rattles a saber out there. He's strange. He has a weird way about him. He came back to Arkansas after years away as a consultant.
Although he hasn't declared his intentions to run for Senate, Max Brantley says that $100,000 was raised just last week for Congressman Cotton. Benton County officials are beginning the process of considering construction of a new county courts building. The county has hired an architect and courthouse design consultant from Denver, Colorado, to conduct a feasibility study to replace the current courts building that was built in 1928. The feasibility study will take about 5 months and will look at a couple of sites downtown and one on Highway 102 near the county jail. Bob Clenard, Benton County judge, says the current facility is functionally obsolete. The layout puts plaintiffs, defendants, jurors, judges, and the general public in hallways and stairwells together, a safety concern that would be fixed with a modern layout in a new courts building.
Say the core of the building may be the courtrooms, and on one end of the building it's maybe two, three-story will be the judges and the prosecutors, and on the other end of the building would be the public, and everybody comes in a different entrance. You have different lobbies, you have different elevators and stairwells for each one of those areas. The only time that everyone is together is when they come together in the courtroom, and that's, of course, highly secure.
Because planning for a new courts building is just in the planning stages, actual cost of construction is unknown, as is the funding mechanism to aid such a project's construction. But the county judge says the design of a new courts building would have to focus on function rather than form.
You know, I'm for functional space, not Taj Mahal space. I mean, we don't need marble and all of the things that maybe they used to do in fancy courthouses. We need a nice building, but it needs to be functional more than it does fancy.
He says whatever type of courts facility the county eventually builds, it must be built with the idea of planning ahead for the future. He says the current courts facility was built with only one courtroom, but as the number of circuit judges in Benton County has grown to six, the building has been split into three courtrooms, and additional court space has been added in nearby buildings. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals closed out the month of June with two wins and a loss this weekend. Friday night, the Nats defeated the Midland Rockhounds 7-3. That meant they swept Midland in that three-game series. Then the Nats lost a 10-7 decision at home Saturday against the Frisco Rough Riders, but the Naturals made up for Saturday's loss yesterday with an 8-5 win over Frisco. The Naturals' six-game homestand concludes tonight at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows in the lower 50s in northwest Arkansas. Not bad for the 1st of July. Lows around 60 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, slight chance of afternoon showers. Highs will be from 78 to 83 throughout the region. And tomorrow night, partly cloudy, lows between 53 and 61. This is Ozarks at Large for the first day of July 2013. Last January, the U.S. Department of the Interior designated the White River Watershed as a National Blueway, the second river to be honored in the nation. The title recognizes and supports a new generation of river watershed stewardship. But as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, a conservative Arkansas interest group claiming the designation is a covert government operation roused enough opposition to shut the initiative down.
A national blueway is a regionally significant watershed, highly valued for its recreational, social, economic, cultural, and ecological assets. And it fully describes the 722-mile-long White River, which flows north from the Boston Mountains into Missouri before crossing south into the Mississippi alluvial plain across East Arkansas. The 28,000-square-mile watershed was nominated to be a blueway by the National Wildlife Refuge Association based in Washington, D.C. The blueway system was initiated several years ago by U.S. Department of Interior secretarial order to both honor and provide federal assistance to designated watersheds. Nominating agencies in Arkansas and Missouri were thrilled to secure blueway status for the White River. 26 cooperating agencies and NGOs from both states are on board as an informal White River Blueway coalition, including the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. Deputy Director Mike Armstrong.
The nomination was an outgrowth of some work that we were already doing with most of the core partners in the Blue Way designation, with the Fish and Wildlife Service, with the Natural Heritage Commission here in the state, the Nature Conservancy.
The team became aware of the federal Blue Way program and entered the White River as a prospect through a highly complex application process. The paperwork was submitted last summer, the award announced in January. But momentum ground to a halt this June after a small but vocal right-wing property rights group managed to convince enough people living in the watershed that the Blue Way designation is a covert government plot. By June 26th, the coalition members agreed to draft a letter to the U.S. Department of Interior requesting the designation be withdrawn.
Yes, the state agencies will collaborate and draft a letter. Don't have that exact wording worked out, but essentially it'll basically say, you know, we appreciate the recognition of the watershed designation, but given the circumstances that it has elicited controversy about its interpretation and how it will be unfolded, we believe that it's best at this time to remove the designation.
That agreement came out of an Arkansas Legislative House and Senate Committee on City, County, and Local Affairs held at the state capitol following hours of testimony by federal and state agents. At center of the vociferous proceedings was Jeannie Burlsworth, founder and chair of Secure Arkansas, a state sovereignty, constitutional, and property rights advocacy group. She's been telling anyone who will listen that under a Blue Way mandate, the entire river corridor will be declared a wild riparian wetland and forest buffer zone, resulting in the forced removal of whole communities and farms.
It was about a federal land grab, and that's what this was about, and this is why there is so much outrage, and the public outcry is going to get even greater if the federal government doesn't back off.
Burlsworth contacted 60 county governments up and down the Blue Way, urging quorum courts to issue resolutions against it. More than 30 have agreed, she said, with 15 resolutions currently on the books. Even though Department of Interior Blue Way's documentation states no orders exist to authorize or affect the use of private property or to exercise regulatory authority or interfere with state or tribal land and water rights.
Really? Because they say this is not intended to take private property rights, was in their MOU, their Memorandum of Understanding. But intentions, you know, you could intend to do, you know, set out and, you know, drive somewhere and not anticipate a car wreck, and you intended to get there, but something happens.
Burlsworth insists that if the Blue Way partnership were to go forward, all 8 U.S. Army Corps of Engineer dams in Arkansas and Missouri that impound the White River for flood control and recreation will be torn down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They talk about in their own documents about levees and you know what they've got to take out, but yeah, I think every man-made dam, Bull Shoals, Taney Como, Beaver, Norfolk, I think they're all targeted.
Right, and I don't know why Jeannie would come to that conclusion.
Arkansas Game and Fish Commission Deputy Director Mike Armstrong.
You know, it's unfortunate, and then there's misinformation being fed into that folks that are kind of outside the you know, the whole politics of behind this. You know, I can understand where they would have some concern in fear of that. And so that's what we as in the conservation community need to do a better job on that. You know, if we're going to move forward on our core principles, then we need to find a way to calm those fears or assuage those fears that this is not it's not going to lead to new takings or new infringements on private property rights. That was not in our consideration.
And even though the request to remove the White River's Blue Way designation will be issued in a posting on her Secure Arkansas website, Jeannie Burlsworth warns that the Department of Interior hasn't indicated it will overturn the designation. But in an email response for this report, U.S. Department of Interior spokeswoman Jessica Kershaw said they are fully aware the request is pending, and once received, the department will act expeditiously to address it. Jeannie Bolesworth's influence has even affected 9 congressional members from Arkansas and Missouri who've issued a letter to the U.S. Department of Interior claiming the Blue Way designation lacked transparency and public input and was unilaterally enacted by the executive branch without clear legal authority. The delegation has requested a means to opt out. The National Blue Way System was established in May of 2012 by the Interior Department to provide assistance to river communities to manage their own watersheds. The White River was the second in the nation to be designated. The first is the Connecticut River, designated in May of 2012, initiated by Patrick M. Cummins, Director of Bird Conservation for Audubon, Connecticut, and Chairman of the Friends of the Conty Fish and Wildlife Refuge.
It's been a great process so far. It's really helped to align various partners who are have different interests, because it's not just a conservation program. It's about conservation. It's about outdoor recreation, which is an industry in some parts of the watershed. And it's about sustainable economic development, and it's about environmental education as well.
Hummond says conservative property rights groups also function in his watershed, but none have come forward to oppose the designation.
Due to the strength of this partnership, the grassroots, if you will, that we're speaking up for the importance of the river, both as a natural resource and as an economic resource in the Northeast for the 4 New England states through which it runs. And that is really what got the attention of the Department of the Interior and had the site recognized as a national blue way.
So while the Connecticut River Blue Way has experienced a cooperative launch, the Arkansas Blue Way initiative has crashed hard. Amy Kober, spokesperson for American Rivers, a leading organization working to protect and restore our nation's rivers and streams, believes Arkansas Blue Way facilitators did the right thing pulling the plug.
Well, we think that that the Blue Ways program is entirely voluntary and locally driven. And if the local communities and local businesses don't want the Blue Way designation, they shouldn't have it. So it's entirely appropriate if the designation is being withdrawn at the community's request. There are plenty of other communities, river communities around the country who would like to be part of the Blue Ways program.
But Debbie Doss, conservation chair of the Arkansas Canoe Club, a Blue Way supporter, is devastated the project failed.
We were really excited because we felt like we were going to get the recognition by the rest of the whole country, really, for what a special place this is.
But now Arkansas is being cast in a much different light. In a last-minute email urging support, Debbie Doss characterized Secure Arkansas's campaign as paranoid and pleaded for rational discourse.
You know, it's antithetical to the entire purpose of the Blue Way program, which is to celebrate partnership and cooperation.
Before the decision to withdraw, the White River Blue Way Coalition, including the Nature Conservancy, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Arkansas USDA Forest Service, Arkansas U.S. Geological Survey in Arkansas, Trout Unlimited, both Arkansas and Missouri Farm Bureaus, and state universities, were set to launch a series of public meetings up and down the river corridor to reach out to communities so they could design a Blue Way strategy by consensus. Instead, the coalition plans to regroup to figure out exactly what went haywire. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And still to come on this edition of Ozarks at Large, Christina Thomas sits down with writer and historian Dr. Stuart Towns about his new book detailing how oratory in the years following the Civil War still has an influence in the South and Arkansas. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle. 11. The restaurant at Crystal Ridges Museum of American Art serves modern American comfort food with an Ozark twist. Wednesday and Friday evenings offer Culture Hour from 5 until 7 with live music and dinner until 9 p.m. featuring a monthly chef's tasting menu. Dinner reservations suggested. More information available online at crystalbridges.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, from gay marriage to the Voting Rights Act to affirmative action, it's been a busy term at the Supreme Court. We'll wrap it up with Nina Totenberg. Also, the nuns who are topping the classical charts.
We are singing together so often throughout the day. Our voices, our whole heart kind of becomes one.
That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now.
Here and Now, this afternoon, beginning at 1 on KUAF 91.3 FM. As the fiscal year ended this past week for many organizations and businesses, there was big money news in Arkansas. For his usual Monday wrap-up of the past 7 days' business and political news, Roby Brock begins with a change in the Arkansas banking community.
Conway-based Home Bank Shares, parent company of Centennial Bank, will acquire Jonesboro-based Liberty Bank Shares in a $280 million deal. The transaction is the largest in-state banking deal in the history of Arkansas and makes publicly traded Home Bank Shares the second largest bank holding company headquartered in the state. Nearly 400 Liberty shareholders will receive $250 million in common stock and $30 million in cash as part of the transaction. All told, there will be 151 banking locations in Arkansas, Alabama, and Florida. 92 of those will be in-state. The combined banks will have $7.1 billion in assets, $5.6 billion in deposits, $4.5 billion in loans, and employ nearly 1,500 workers. Three countries, China, Japan, and Russia, have stopped importing poultry from Arkansas because of an outbreak of avian flu in one commercial chicken house in Scott County, a possible blow to the state's economy. The outbreak of avian flu, discovered June 16th on a farm in the Bowles community of Scott County, was contained to one chicken house, and testing of all poultry within a 6-mile radius has been negative. Arkansas State University System President Dr. Charles Welch said Arkansas needs to make a transformative investment in higher education. Without dedicated capital funding for the state's 2-year and 4-year colleges, there is no funding for major initiatives seen in similar states, he said. Long term, universities cannot and should not continue to make incremental improvements and try to stay competitive on the shoulders of students through continued tuition increases. Welch said that the resolve shown for significant economic investments in secondary education and highways must also be demonstrated for universities and colleges. Governor Mike Beebe told members of the Northwest Arkansas Council, an influential business group in the region, that they need to support the private option health insurance plan passed by state lawmakers. A group seeking to repeal the plan is collecting signatures for a potential ballot initiative. Beebe said the group had a, quote, public responsibility to stand against the effort. A 68-32 vote on immigration reform was a display of bipartisan support in the U.S. Senate, but it split Arkansas's senatorial delegation. The U.S. Senate voted to approve the immigration reform measure, which still must clear a Republican-controlled House of Representatives. Senator Mark Pryor, a Democrat, voted in favor of the bill, while Senator John Bozeman, a Republican, opposed it. The legislation includes a 13-year pathway for 11 million undocumented immigrants to earn legal status in the U.S. It also includes enhanced border security measures and increases the number of visas available for high-skilled workers and entrepreneurs, as well as visas for temporary agricultural workers. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas files his weekly wrap-up for Ozarks at Large on most Mondays. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks is provided by Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. The Civil War may have ended nearly 150 years ago, but the conflict's ghosts continue to swirl. Last week's headlines about the Civil Rights Voting Act and a disgraced celebrity chef put a spotlight on tensions with connections to the Civil War. Dr. Stuart Towns, a retired professor in and department chair for the Communication Studies Department at Southeast Missouri State University, contends much of Southern attitude has been influenced by rousing speeches delivered by Confederate veterans and sympathizers in the years immediately following the Civil War. He writes about those speeches and their lasting effect in his book, Enduring Legacy, Rhetoric and Ritual of the Lost Cause. This weekend, he was in Northwest Arkansas to speak at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History in Springdale. During his visit, he came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to talk about his book with Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas.
I think you could write a book, and in fact, I may wind up doing it someday, about the history of the South or the history of the United States, and just use the speeches that were made as your primary source material, because they've set the standard. You go back to Patrick Henry's Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death, and bring it all the way up to the recent times, some of Ronald Reagan's speeches when he stood by the Berlin Wall and told the Russian premier to tear that wall down. We've had the speech making in our history has really determined our history in so many ways.
How is it different in the South? Speeches were kind of the universities
right.
of the South back
That's
in the
exactly
1800s.
Right. That's right.
So how is that different than other places in
well,
the United States?
The South is very much an oral culture. We love to tell stories. We, the William Faulkners that lie within all of us, I think. We love to tell stories. We get together with our families and we reminisce about things that went on in the family two generations behind us, And we're an oral culture. And so in the South, during the antebellum period and all the way through the 19th century and into the 20th century, we love to tell stories. And that is built into our genes almost, it seems like.
My first instinct was because, the South kind of has this reputation, and even 200 years ago, of not being maybe brightest,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We have, more people are illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
And even
mm-hmm.
today, mm-hmm. our education system is
right.
not. My immediate thought was, mm-hmm. okay, well, they just had to listen because
right.
they couldn't read.
That's a big part of it. That's a huge part of it. No question about it. It still is a rural society in many places. And the education system is not the best in the country. And so we've had to. To spend a lot of our time listening. That's exactly right. That's a good way of looking at it.
So this book, Enduring Legacy, The Rhetoric and Ritual of the Lost Cause, mm-hmm. is primarily about the Lost Cause movement
right.
in the South
right.
During and after the Civil War.
Right.
And you use quotes that aren't generals
mm-hmm.
and not just prominent people. It's
right.
not Abraham Lincoln. It's
yeah,
it's
right.
everybody.
That's
it's
right.
soldiers.
That's right.
And
exactly. And what I've tried to do is to look at the common person. I've tried to look at how this public memory of the Lost Cause was created through speechmaking at these three events: the Confederate monument dedications. There's over 1,000 Confederate monuments dedicated to the Confederate soldier or the Confederacy or the Old South or the women of the Confederacy or whatever, all over the South. And Arkansas has probably 35 or 40 of them. And
there's one on the Bentonville Square.
The one on the Bentonville yeah. Square. I took a picture of it the last time I was up here. There's one up just several blocks away from where we're sitting right now at the Confederate Cemetery up there. They're all over. And every time you had one of those dedicated, you had a speech. And that speech was practically the same everywhere. They talk about the heroes of the Confederacy, the way that the Confederate soldier fought and how heroic he was, and in spite of the fact that the North had so many more soldiers and so many more materials and so many more industries and railroads and so on, and he's almost doomed from the start to lose, but because of that. But they talked about it. And then also they had Confederate Memorial Day. The women of the South honored the dead Confederates, the ones that were buried in their local graveyard. They go down there on Memorial Day and clean everything up and spruce it up, put flowers out, and you had a speaker. Somebody made a speech, just like they still do right here up in the Confederate Cemetery every year. 140 years in a row now. I think they're up to 140, their 140th one. That, and then the old soldiers getting together after the war, just like soldiers have done for eons, ever since man has had wars, they've had the old soldiers get together and have reunions and talk about, tell war stories and tell lies about what they did in the war and share that with each other. And you had a speaker, or a bunch of speakers, actually, and they would talk about the war and talk about the Lost Cause. And so that was just repeated over and over and over and over again for just decades. And so that got ingrained in the memory of the South. The white South just made part of their life. And so that's why we're celebrating the sesquicentennial of the war. The Civil War was such a momentous event in our history as Americans, Southerners as well as Northerners, black and white. And so we're still celebrating it today. And part of the reason we're still celebrating it is all those hundreds and hundreds of speeches that were made at those three events all over the South, and that's what the book's about.
How were these speeches recorded? You know, this was before the days of recording.
They would print them. There'd be a local group, maybe the Memorial Association or the Ladies Monument Association or the United Confederate Veterans Organization would have them printed, and then I found hundreds of them in libraries all over the South. I've looked all over from Maryland and Virginia all the way down to Texas and just dozens of libraries. And in most libraries that I've looked in, there have been speeches that I've found. And you know, I've got copies of them in my files, hundreds of them. The newspapers, local newspaper, would have them, big excerpts from them on the very front page of the newspaper in many cases. In some cases, it'd be the entire speech that the person had given.
So what was the general attitude?
The general thing they were trying to do, it kind of shifted from one time to another, but immediately after the war, for the first couple of decades, what they were trying to do is to kind of lift the South up. They had been defeated. They had been not just defeated, but crushed by the South. All the major battles except Gettysburg were fought in the South, and so destruction was just widespread. The South lost hundreds of thousands of men in the prime of their life. And so their economy was shot. Cream of the crop of their men had been killed or maimed in the war. And so what the orators were trying to do in those first couple of decades was just kind of uplift them and say, hey, we're going to get back on our feet. We're going to get things going again. And so that was the first couple of decades. Then it began to shift into a more prideful kind of thing, looking back and say, you know, we fought this war, we were heroic in what we did, we really worked hard at it, we were fighting for something we believed in. They had kind of rebuilt their pride, and so now they were kind of demonstrating that pride and say, by golly, we were good soldiers, you know, some of the greatest soldiers in the history of mankind, and Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and all these guys were really great soldiers. And
so, well, what about like during, Reconstruction?
Yeah, Reconstruction, a lot of Southerners felt like Reconstruction was as bad as the war or worse. They really did. They just simply just felt like the Reconstruction was being revengeful and, you know, trying to put the South down even further. They'd lost the war and they now tried to keep pounding them even after the war was over with the Reconstruction issues and bills and Reconstruction governments across the South and so on. And so I've got a number of speeches that talked, say, in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s about Reconstruction being just as bad as the war was, just in many ways. And so they believe that. And I've got some speeches in the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement where people like Faubus and George Wallace from Alabama, Ross Barnett from Mississippi, used the Lost Cause as part of their justification for segregation.
They actually referred back to it.
That's right, exactly. And I have said many times that the South lost the war, but they won the peace, because after Reconstruction was over, the South was just allowed by the Supreme Court, the President, the Congress, just basically ignored the creation of the segregated society in the South. And so they lost the war, but won the peace. They were allowed to do whatever they wanted to do to set up the segregated system.
Orville Faubus and Barnett, mm-hmm. and you mentioned these people, and you mentioned
right.
the civil rights movement,
right.
and you mentioned that the federal government just kind of let the states mm-hmm. do the segregation, but we're not segregated anymore.
Right, but we're still remembering the Civil War. We're still celebrating it, and I think it's still very much alive and well today. And if you stop to think about it, we may not be segregated, but we still have a lot of racial issues in the country, not just in the South, but in the country. The immigration issue that we're battling over right now is in part a racial issue. We still have issues about what's the relationship between the federal government and the states. That was a Civil War issue. We're still talking about that
right.
today. It's not settled by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I mean, just this week has been a big week for, I mean, for a few of those things.
Yeah.
I mean, with the Supreme
right.
Court decisions.
That's right.
And
exactly.
Paula Deen has been in the news.
Exactly. So
it's been a big week.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not going to go away. I mean, I think that the South is, there are a lot of people in the South who had relatives in their families who fought for the side of the South in the Civil War. I've got a couple of them that I know of for sure. My wife has some relatives. She's a member of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. I'm a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. And we do that as a way of memorializing and honoring people and remembering people in our family who fought in the war. And it's just like we would memorialize somebody that, in our family who fought in World War II. I was up in Washington just last couple of weeks ago and went to, as at the World War II memorial up there, which is so impressive. And three busloads of veterans from World War II drove up to see the, got their wheelchairs out and their canes out. And they were just, I got goosebumps just looking at the memorial myself, and I'm not a World War II veteran. And you see these guys coming in, and they were, you could just see the expression on their face. They were just stunned by this memorial. Well, we memorialize those people that were in our families, and so we're doing the same thing about people in our family who had fought in the war. And so that's why the Sons of Confederate Veterans or the United Daughters of the Confederacy or the Military Order of the Stars and Bars are still active today, and very much active. They still have the reenactments out at Prairie Grove, the reenactment back in December, and a horrible day, it was pouring down rain, and yet there were thousands of people out there to watch the reenactment. And part of the reason why is because of the speeches that were made that I talk about in the book that helped to create this public memory that we still have 150 years later.
Is there anything comparable in history? I mean, bring up World War II and that memorial, but is it comparable?
If you put it in the context of how many people were killed in during the Civil War, almost 750,000 Americans died in the Civil War. That's more than every other war in our history up until the Vietnam, not including the Vietnam War, but up to the Vietnam War. There's more people killed in the Civil War, died during the Civil War, soldiers who died during the Civil War than all the rest of our wars combined. And so from that standpoint, it was really you couldn't compare it to anything. It's just a matter of it was so much impact on our culture, and so much of the South was devastated by the war. Some people would say they haven't even recovered now in the South from a lot of that because we're still behind economically. It's still a rural area. It's still an area that's, as you pointed out a while ago, behind in some educational areas and so on. And so it had a huge impact on the South, no doubt, no question about it. And I'm not sure you can compare it to anything else. Like Shelby Foote said, he's one of my favorite historians, and he was talking about the Civil War the Civil War series that Ken Burns did several years ago on television, and he said it was the major crossroads of our history, and he said it was a hell of a crossroads, and that's I think it was that's a good way to put it.
Well, the cover of this book, it's an SUV, kind of a rough truck,
right,
flying a Confederate flag.
Yeah.
I mean, the Confederate flag is, it's a big issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, even today,
sure
schools
is.
Ban.
That's right.
Kids wearing
right.
shirts.
That's
and
right.
I mean, Georgia changed their flag.
Right.
The Arkansas flag is sort of.
Right. That's right. It has something to do. But I think that's a big issue. And the fact that the Confederate flag has been used by groups like the KKK as their symbol. And there's a big issue right now going on in Memphis. The Memphis City Council voted back in, I guess it was January, to change the name of Nathan Bedford Forrest Park over there. And there's also a Jefferson Davis Park and a Confederate Park in town, down by the Mississippi River, that they wanted to change the name of that too, of all three of those. And the Sons of Confederate Veterans over there were up in arms against that, trying to oppose it. And one of the comments one of them made to me was, if we can just keep the KKK out of this, we might can win. If the KKK gets involved, there's no way we can win. And so I think that's a good example of the fact that during the Civil Rights Movement of the 50s and 60s, the Confederate flag was waved as a symbol of opposition to integration. And when it's really not that. I think I like the bumper sticker that I've seen. It says "Heritage, not hate," and it's a Sons of Confederate Veterans bumper sticker. And what they're trying to say there is we're trying to honor the heritage of our families, the heritage of our region, which is part of the heritage of all Southerners. Every Southerner Southern family at that era was touched by the Civil War. Every black family was touched by the Civil War. There's a comment in the book about a Georgian legislator who from Atlanta, who made a comment after a long debate about the flag in Georgia. He said, you know, I finally got to the point of realizing that just because somebody has a different opinion from yours on this issue, they don't hate you. And I think that's a good way of looking at it. You know, the history is our history, and we shouldn't try to erase that.
Right.
We need to keep it. Yeah, and understand it. Try to understand it. And I think that's what my book tries to do, is to help people understand better how the history was created and how it got to the point that it is today, why it is like it is today. So.
Well, you spend a lot of time traveling around and speaking.
Right. Right.
So why? Why is that something that you enjoy doing?
The main reason is I want to get the word out about this how this public memory was created and why it was so important and why it's still, you know, why we celebrate the Civil War today would be a good, you know, why the Civil War still matters today.
Well, and here you are giving speeches. Mm-hmm. Are you yourself creating some sort of oral history?
I'm sure I am. Yeah, I'm sure people. In fact, I've had a number of people make very favorable comments and say, you know, I didn't understand all of this till I read your book. I gave one talk over in Little Rock, and I had three fellows come up after it was over, and all three of them had retired to Little Rock. One of them from Iowa, and a couple of them from Illinois, I think. And they said, you know, you talked about some things tonight that I've been trying to figure out and understand, and I think I now understand more about the South after hearing you talk about. And I said, well, that's exactly why I'm talking about it. You know, I want people to understand more about the South and why the South is like it is and how the memories of the Civil War are really still important to us.
Yeah. Stuart Towns is the author of the book Enduring Legacy, Rhetoric and Ritual of the Lost Cause. He spoke this weekend at the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History, and while he was in town, also spoke to Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas. And this is the first day of July, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me on the phone from her favorite place in the world, New Orleans, Louisiana, is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. How are you, Becca?
Good morning, Northwest Arkansas.
You love New Orleans.
I do love New Orleans. And, you know, no matter how many times you've been here, you learn different things. We went on a walking tour yesterday that started in Jackson Square and wound up at the Ursuline Convent. Oh. Did you know that the statue of Andrew Jackson that's in Jackson Square weighs 20,000 pounds, rather?
I did not know that. That's a heavy object.
It was assembled in pieces. It came from a foundry down sort of where Louis Armstrong Park is now. The artist's name was Clark Mills. And they brought it in pieces and assembled it in 1856. It was the first bronze equestrian statue cast in the United States by an American sculptor. Hmm. And the first equestrian statue in the world balanced on two legs. How's that for cool learning experiences in New Orleans?
And speaking of cool, we had an incredibly, for July or late June, early July, cool day yesterday and night and morning today. It's been...
I have been keeping up with you on Twitter, and I only can say it's a million degrees here, but I'm in New Orleans.
That's right. That's what you expect.
If you are, however, in Northwest Arkansas, you can plan ahead for an event called Funk on the 4th. It's the second annual American Funk Dance Party with DJ Derek, Mix 10, and DJ EJ that happens from 9 to 2 a.m.
Where does this take place?
This is on the 4th of July at the Smoke and Barrel Tavern in Fayetteville, and admission is free.
Well, you can't beat that.
Or you can save your nickels, because there's a band called Alabama Shakes coming to the Arkansas Music Pavilion.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Kinder, the music writer for What's Up, says this is a marquee name. Grammy-nominated Southern rock band, and they will be there September 6th, the Friday night. Tickets for the 7:30 p.m. show are $38.50, and they are on sale now at amptickets.com. Also going on sale now are tickets for Vampire Weekend, which I know nothing about, but I sure like the name.
September
25th.
Yeah, they'll be later in the fall as well, and their latest album has just come out.
See? I know nothing about music, but I know a lot about beignets, and I'm going to go have some now.
All right, I'll talk to you tomorrow, Becca. Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
My purpose in going to Washington is to inform the country what's wrong with it. Let me tell you about it. Everybody's trying to figure out what's wrong with the country. Well, I'm proud to say I've solved the case. 'Cause after dilly-dallying, shilly-shallying, I've reached a concussion. The state of Arkansas is in the wrong place.
Musicians and Songs of Import can be found across the state of Arkansas, and Arkansongs attempts to chronicle as many as possible. However, sometimes some of the most interesting songs of Arkansas come from beyond the state's borders. One of the most comedic songs about Arkansas, with decades of heavy competition, is Move the State of Arkansas. The song became a showstopper for Jimmy Durante, who is credited co-writer. Move the State of Arkansas posits the theory that the state is located in the wrong place, causing problems with the country. Then, moving Arkansas causes all sorts of other switching around and problems to occur. In this version, Durante explains Arkansas landed in the wrong area because President Van Buren misplaced it. In another version, Durante says when it came time to join the Union, Arkansas couldn't afford to pay the dues.
My name it is Bill Stafford. I was born in Buffalo Town. And for 9 or 10 long years, I've roamed this world around. I've bummed this wide world over and trouble I have saw. But I didn't know what misery was till I come to Arkansas.
A song told from a non-Arkansas-er's point of view with much older origins is the song The State of Arkansas. It's also known as Bill Stafford and as the Arkansas Traveler 2. The narrator comes to Arkansas to work, but finds the state, the work, and the food disagreeable. The version recorded here is recorded by Gus Mahon. The first known publishing of The State of Arkansas is 1891. Mahon was born in Earl in Crittenden County in 1879, so he'd probably heard the song for most of his life. This recording dates from 1962 in Heber Springs and was released in 2008 on Volume 2 of The Sounds of the Ozark Folk, the second issued collection from the recordings of the Lyon College John Quincy Wolfe Folklore Collection. The release was produced by the late Brooks Blevins.
I paid to him $5, which gave my heart a shock. Straight away I landed off the cars in the town of Little Rock. Up stepped a living skeleton with his long and lantering jaws and invited me to his hotel in the state of Arkansas.
My name is Sanford Barnes, come from a noble town. Travel the wide world over, travel the wide world round. Had my ups and downs in life and better days I saw.
This version of the same song was performed in 1950 by Booth Campbell in Cane Hill, Arkansas, in Washington County, and includes banjo accompaniment. Campbell, often seen with his pipe and a long white beard, performed at festivals in a Confederate Army uniform. Campbell died in 1956 at age 84. This recording is from the Mary C. Parlor Archive of Arkansas Folk Music, curated by the Center of Arkansas and Regional Studies in Fayetteville.
I saw that Jolly Bombers carrying around the news. I gave him $5, but it gave my heart a shock. When I started to the city, they called it Little Rock. I landed in Fort Smith one sultry afternoon. I walked across from the depot, stepped into a saloon. Up stepped a living skeleton with a long and lantern jaw. Invited me around to the best hotel in the state of Arkansas.
And they're all songs of Arkansas. Here in its entirety is Move the State of Arkansas, performed by Jimmy Durante from a radio broadcast from sometime in the 1940s.
My purpose in going to Washington is to inform the country what's wrong with it. Let me tell you about it. Everybody's trying to figure out what's wrong with the country. Well, I'm proud to say I've solved the case. 'Cause after dilly-dallying, shilly-shallying, I've reached a concussion. The state of Arkansas is in the wrong place. It's Van Buren's fault. When he was president, he mislaid it. Why nobody ever thought of it before, I'll never know. It's a simple little move. but what improvements it'll show. Move the state of Arkansas to Nebraska, then move Nebraska to Idaho, then move the state of Idaho to Alaska, and move Alaska to Ohio. It took a lot of time and brain work. See the wrinkles on my brow. Why, there's lots of little details, but I'm working on them now. Move Ohio to Nevada. It's as plain as ABC. Then we'll move Nevada, where our Kansas used to be. We'll have a better nation just by changing the location of the state of Arkansas. Let me show you what I mean. If you move Arkansas, you gotta move it someplace, right?
Right.
And if you move it someplace, you gotta move what was someplace to someplace else, right?
Right.
And if you move what was someplace else to someplace else, you gotta move what was someplace else to some other place else, right?
Right.
Wrong. I always admire a guy who speaks his mind. My plan is to move all the state to better places. Believe me, I'd take Nebraska and put it in Rhode Island. I'd take Minnesota and put it in Rhode Island. I'd take Montana and put it in Rhode Island. Poor little Rhode Island just split at the seams. After that, I'd move New Mexico to Texas. Texas to Pennsylvania. Then I'd take the state of Missouri and move it to... Don't get mad, Mr. Truman. I'll put it back. And then to add glamour to the national capital, I'd take Hollywood and move it to Washington, D.C. Why, I can just see the neon sign on the White House. Louis B. Mayer presents Congress. 96 gorgeous senators and Gene Autry and his horse. Jimmy Fiddler just gave it one bell. That makes it unanimous. We'll have a better nation just by changing the location of the state of Arkansas.
Jimmy Durante performing Move the State of Arkansas from a 1940s radio broadcast. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Carrie DeVore. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. Average retail gasoline prices in Arkansas have fallen more than 5.5 cents per gallon the past week, averaging yesterday $3.27 per gallon. That's according to Gas Buddy's daily survey of more than 1,800 gas outlets in Arkansas. Including the change in gas prices in Arkansas during the past 7 days, prices yesterday were 19 cents per gallon higher than June 30th, 2012, but are 6 cents per gallon lower than just a month ago. The 15th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Series welcomes American bebop and jazz pianist, composer, and singer Bob Dorough to the Walton Arts Center Star Theater Saturday, July 13th. Dorough has worked with Miles Davis and Allen Ginsberg and is the voice and composer of songs used in Schoolhouse Rock. More information is available at waltonartscenter.org or KUAF.com. And support for KUAF comes from PittmanCounseling.com and therapist Sean Pittman, providing private counseling services in both Fayetteville and Rogers. Sean offers over 20 years of experience in mental health care. More information is available at PittmanCounseling.com. And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Ozark. On tomorrow's new edition of Ozarks at Large, that you can hear at noon and 7 on KUAF, the sometimes delicate balance in Eureka Springs between business and residence. Jacqueline Froelich will have that story for us. Plus, a conversation with writer Steve Yates about his brand new collection of short stories called Some Kinds of Love. Steve earned his MFA at the University of Arkansas and worked for a time at the University of Arkansas Press. Now he lives in Mississippi, and his latest collection of short stories, Some Kinds of Love, has been published by the University of Massachusetts Press. That conversation and much more on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on KUAF. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. You can learn more about us at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for spending part of your Monday with us. Talk to you tomorrow.